Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds. And they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This episode is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. It's never an easy call with so many problems in the world to know where to direct the money that you donate when you want to help out in this world. But what I can tell you is that when you donate to CAMH, you're saving lives. We know about the opioid crisis. We know about the mental health crisis. They are doing the work. Help change mental health care forever. Your support will help CAMH build a future where no one is left behind. Donate at CAMH.ca/CanadaLand to help us treat addiction and build hope. This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by Douglas, a mattress that is trusted by more than 200,000 Canadians from coast to coast to coast. It's a great mattress at a very reasonable price point. Comes with a 20-year warranty and a great deal for our listeners. Douglas is giving you a free sleep bundle with each mattress purchase. Get the sheets, pillows, mattress, and pillow protectors free with your Douglas purchase today. Visit douglas.ca/CanadaLand to claim this offer. That is douglas.ca/CanadaLand.
Luke Savage, staff writer at Jacobin, co-host of the Michael and Us podcast, and guy whose career once got a boost from Glenn Greenwald back at a time when that was really a big positive. Welcome to Shortcuts.
Thanks so much for having me, Jonathan. It still feels like a luxury to, you know, record a podcast in person.
Very glad to have you here. Today on the show, how to blow up a pipeline, or where statecraft meets Minecraft. And a conservative MP went on a federal government-wide fishing expedition for examples of government overreach on social media and found one example. I'm Jonathan Goldsby. Welcome to Shortcuts, where we talk shit about the news. This episode is brought to you by Gillian Anderson, Rebecca Rooney, Silas Zureb, Christy Cruz, Justin Scherer, Heather Rusk, Jimmy Latin, and Shauna.
I'm Shauna. I'm a bookkeeper in Vancouver, BC. I support Canada Land because Jesse Brown and his team are an important media voice in Canada. I like the podcast format that allows for a deeper dive into a news issue. Despite Jesse talking too much, he does get a discussion going, and he's unafraid of uncomfortable disagreement with guests. I also enjoy the special issue series like Monopoly, Mining, and The White Saviors. My one suggestion would be to spread some of the coverage to Western Canada.
U.S. officials scramble after a document leak, including reportedly sensitive intel on the war in Ukraine.
Pro-Russian hackers allegedly targeting a Canadian company.
This leak had been traced back to a Discord server about video games and YouTubers.
In regards to the reports of cyber attacks against Canadian energy infrastructure, I can confirm that there was no physical damage to any Canadian energy infrastructure following cyber attacks.
As the Globe and Mail put it, that was a carefully phrased statement from the Prime Minister on Tuesday. There was no physical damage, leaving open the possibility, I suppose, of emotional damage or spiritual damage or mostly.
Was the pipeline okay?
Yeah. How does the pipeline feel? Is it spiritually coherent? Is it still looking for its purpose? Most likely, if it wasn't physical damage, there could have been economic damage that could, you know, the sort that could be caused by a system that's been compromised or disrupted, but not, you know, actually blown up. But let's take a step back. So on Sunday afternoon, the New York Times published a report with the headline, a pro-Russian hacking group may have targeted Canada's energy infrastructure. The 600-word web story was just one item in a larger roundup the Times published, offering an overview of miscellaneous revelations contained in a trove of Pentagon documents that had basically just appeared online. A few hours after the Times story, the Globe followed up with its own report, which later found a place of prominence on the top of Monday's paper. So both stories offered summaries of a seemingly authentic U.S. intelligence assessment based on intercepted communications between a group of hackers and the FSB, which is Russia's state security apparatus, the successor to the KGB. And so the semi-independent hacking group known as Zarya had essentially boasted to the FSB that they'd managed to gain remote access to a Canadian gas pipeline such that they'd be able to fiddle with the controls and cause it to shut down or perhaps even blow up. The FSB officers anticipated a successful operation would cause an explosion at the gas distribution station and were monitoring Canadian news reports for indications of an explosion. The Times quoted the assessment as saying, "The U.S. believed the goal wasn't to cause loss of life, but rather economic damage, and that as of the end of February, the hackers were awaiting guidance on what to do next." So the geopolitical implications are interesting, really interesting, but I'm actually kind of more fascinated by the chain of events that led to us learning about this, or at least learning what the U.S. thinks about this. What did you make of it when this came to your attention?
Well, I do think the story is interesting and that there's a lot to discuss here. I mean, I think we're going to talk about a lot of different things related to this particular leak. But when it comes to this specific question of the pipeline, I actually, frankly, don't see a whole lot here. I mean, the Globe story right off the top, you know, there are a number of pretty important qualifiers. You know, the first thing is that the hacking group is actually independent of the Russian government. They're making a claim. Mm-hmm. And the claim, at least as the Globe's article frames it, is, you know, they didn't claim to have, as I understand it, the capability, you know, to disrupt pipeline infrastructure. They claim to have done so. Globe and Mail report goes on to say that, you know, the documents themselves in the leak are unverified. And, you know, mm-hmm. I guess we'll get to that. There's a lot of, you know, mm-hmm. debate about what these documents actually are, whether they've been tampered with, by who, mm-hmm. et cetera. And there are conflicting accounts even from within, even from Ukrainian versus American mm-hmm. officials about what these documents are and the, you know, intended purpose of the leak, that kind of thing. But again, in the case of this pipeline story, the documents in the leak are unverified. And secondly, there's no evidence that any such attack occurred. So whatever this group is claiming, it doesn't seem to be accurate.
It was weird. Until Trudeau's line came to my attention about there having been no physical damage, I'd definitely put this more in the realm of the hypothetical, highly qualified, and whatever. To me, the fact that, and this is just something that occurred to me this morning before we recorded this, as I saw this quote, is like, oh, that doesn't mean anything did happen, but certainly qualifying it that way leaves open at the very least the possibility that something could have happened. And that to me was a little more like, oh, okay, so they're not coming out and ruling that out or excluding that. But yeah, as with any intelligence assessment, as with any intelligence, many potential places for this game of broken telephone to have broken down, to have eroded, whether it was this hacking group maybe just lying for the sake of making themselves sound better, whether it was lying for the sake of, you know, throwing off whoever may be eavesdropping, who knows? There are definitely a lot of qualifiers, and yet it also kind of seems just plausible enough. Like, it seems kind of plausible that it'd be easier for Russian hackers to get into the infrastructure of a Canadian gas pipeline more easily than you can get a cell phone signal in the GTC. But to zoom out a little bit further into how this information eventually came to this point where the Prime Minister is offering these qualified response, the two biggest U.S. intelligence leaks the past decade or so were, of course, the diplomatic cables that Chelsea Manning gave to WikiLeaks in 2010 and the NSA documents that Edward Snowden shared with a handful of journalists in 2013. And in both cases, those were pretty deliberate acts with unambiguous whistleblower intentions. This very much seems to be a lot stupider, kind of a cross between Burn After Reading and Glass Onion. It's just so farcically unsophisticated as to pretty much dispel any notion that there could be some higher end to it. Because whether you're a whistleblower trying to get this out and affect change, or whether you're a state actor trying to seed disinformation, this is probably not how you do it because it's kind of too stupid.
What we know is that a lot of this stuff was dropped in places like Discord servers. It was posted on 4chan. I guess the funniest one is there's a Discord server called Minecraft Earth Map where some of this stuff was put. I have no special insight here, except I guess to just agree with what you just said. I mean, if you're trying to leak documents, this is a very stupid and kind of trolly way to do so. I mean, I guess perhaps it could be a tactic. You know, if you want to leak a bunch of sensitive documents, perhaps it makes sense to, you know, put them somewhere that is not explicitly connected mm-hmm. to the substance of or the content of what's in the leaks, but nevertheless, where there's a very big user base and where, you know, somebody's going to see it.
Yeah. So thanks in large part to reporting by Bellingcat's Eric Toller, later echoed by the Associated Press and others, we sort of have a rough idea of the chain of events that led to the ruining of Easter plans for intelligence officials and national security journalists the world over. Because it wasn't even just a matter of, like, seeding it in a few places. What we believe, or what Eric Toller's reported, is that perhaps as far back as January, there was a Discord, and Discord is kind of like, how would you describe Discord, Luke?
It's a very chaotic platform that I tried to set up for my podcast once, couldn't figure it out, and gave up.
That sounds fair. I've never actually used it. My understanding is it's kind of like Slack for non-work purposes. So there was a Discord called Thug Shaker Central, which is offensive, but not so offensive that I feel uncomfortable saying it, which Bellingcat says was basically a couple dozen people who are interested in video games, music, Orthodox Christianity, and fandom for a YouTuber called Oxide. That seems to be the place where they first trickled out. It's not yet clear who the original person was, but from there it seems to have gradually spread outwards, but very, very gradually. By the start of March, there were 30 documents on a Discord devoted to WowMow, which is a popular Filipino YouTuber I hadn't heard of. By a few days later, the March 4th, they then got into the Minecraft Earthmap Discord, where, as Bellingcat put it, after a brief spat with another person on the server about Minecraft maps and the war in Ukraine, one of the Discord users replied, "Here, have some leaked documents," which I just love. By this month, Wednesday, April 5th, those filtered onto Paul, or the politically incorrect board of 4chan. How would you describe 4chan, Luke?
I mean, I guess 8chan or 8kun, I don't know if that's still up, but, you know, before that, you know, 4chan was considered, you know, the part of the internet, sort of like the least moderated
yes.
part of the internet. It's where you found, like, the most offensive memes yep. and that kind of thing. I guess, you know, it had a tie-in with sort of, you know, the mm-hmm. alt-right and Gamergate and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, also, like, a lot of the great memes, like Rickrolling and many things, a weird number of things in our culture.
That's right. It's a very anarchic place, and I think sometimes it's encoded as being like purely right wing. That's true, but I think a lot of it was also pretty apolitical and just a place where people would share stuff that was sometimes actually quite innocuous. It was just goofy.
Yeah, shitposting. I mean,
totally.
It seemed to describe as like the ass end of the internet. Like, it used to be like the worst place in the internet, but now actually there are a few worse places, but it's one of the worst places.
I actually think there's one other way of looking at 4chan,
sure.
which is that I think it also sort of represented a holdover from an earlier era of the internet, because, you know, before social media, really, you know, before Facebook was launched in sort of, what, 2004, 2005, something like that, YouTube about the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
But sort of in an earlier era of the internet, it really was much more of a Wild West. It was much more anonymous. It was much more kind of forum-based, and the forums were much more kind of decentralized. I think 4chan was sort of a holdover from that as well.
Yeah, I guess that's one way to look at it, and sort of similar how everything in the internet has kind of eroded over time as different sorts of bad actors, including often on the far right, have learned to game algorithms and other particular forms and other mediums. The ruins of a once, if not great, then maybe once okay or tolerable civilization. So from 4chan, it seems to have then spread to a Russian Telegram channel called Donbass Devushka. From there, that seems to be where the New York Times and National Security people first kind of started, first noticed it. And why it only happened to break over the Easter weekend. And I did spend some time, probably too much time, trying to track down the original document in this case. And 4chan pretty much is the only place to go for that. And I found a whole bunch of them. And it's really interesting to see these documents. None of them are scans. They're all photographs. They're all, the pages are yellow. Most of them, except for one that has very clearly been manipulated, the big piece that has sown doubt about the authenticity of these, or whether they may have been authentic at one point and subsequently manipulated, was one slide that, of which there are two versions, one of which definitely appears to have clearly been manipulated. I believe it just transposes some numbers to exaggerate Ukrainian casualties and play down Russian ones, which is the sort of, you know, Russian disinformation that they would engage in, that, you know, in the form of an authentic looking document, say, oh, you know, this is actually the case, more people died. So that's the thing that's largely cast doubt on this. Anyway, I could not find the particular thing about Canada, but I spent quite a lot of time in 4chan too much time. I've seen a lot of horrible things. But I did find a tweet from a guy who appeared to have copies of all of them and was inundated with the quest from reporters, including from the Globe and Mail, Stephen Chase, who chimed in Saturday evening. Another reporter here, would you please DM me the photos? Thanks. So based on all of this, when we talk about intelligence leaks in the context of media, I mean, we think about the stuff reports about maybe Chinese interference. Where do you feel like this fits in within the history of leaks and media and intelligence leaks? Like, how would you contextualize this?
Well, I think it's very difficult, particularly after, you know, in the immediate wake of something like this, to, you know, evaluate its veracity. And in the piece you cited from Bellingcat, I mean, there are a number of different officials who are quoted or alluded to who all seem to be taking very different lines on what the nature of this leak is. So Ukrainian officials are casting, you know, doubt on the veracity of the information. You know, U.S. officials seem to be suggesting that, or, you know, they seem to want to suggest that, you know, the documents are authentic. You know, the Russian position, at least as they've communicated to CNN, is that actually this is NATO engaging in, you know, cyber warfare or, you know, disinformation. But then there's a pro-Russian Telegram channel, possibly the same one you mentioned. And they say they're not convinced that, you know, the documents, you know, are Western disinformation, right? So in terms of the specifics of the leak, I really have no idea. The fact that there are conflicting reports, I suppose, is interesting. What I would say is with any unverified intelligence leak, it's good to have a posture of maximum skepticism at all times. Regardless of what the source of the leak is, regardless of whether it's, you know, coming from Russia or whether it's coming from the United States or a Western aligned country. Suffice it to say that there is a very storied history of unverified intelligence leaks being used by state actors of all kinds to mold a narrative in a way that's, you know, self-interested for them. The Iraq War, possibly one of the most sinister cases I can think of this happening. You know, I was actually revisiting for a piece last month some of the media coverage in the lead up to that war. I mean, it's unbelievable. You know, you have a lot of outlets that are ostensibly independent, I mean, basically acting as appendages of the U.S. state. And one of the things that kind of enabled that, one of the ways that that was done was through the publication of unverified intelligence leaks. So to give you a concrete example, there was a technique that the investigative journalist Seymour Hersh labeled stovepiping. And, you know, this was a method that I guess has its origins, as I understand it, within intelligence agencies. So, you know, if you're Dick Cheney or Donald Rumsfeld and you don't like the things that your own officials are telling you, which presumably have gone through some kind of process, there's been some kind of filter, you can sidestep that process and you can instead appeal to kind of lower level parts of the bureaucracy that are still working with things that, you know, haven't been processed as much, haven't been verified, and you can just, you know, find what intelligence agencies look into all kinds of things, right? So presumably at some point you're going to find something that fits your preferred narrative and you're just going to go with that. And in some cases, that kind of stuff was leaked to the press, materials that are completely unverified and often wouldn't even contain a concrete claim. It would be like U.S. intelligence officials are looking into X, Y, and Z. But then that appears in the New York Times, the Washington Post, a very reputable source. And it kind of has the veil of independence because it looks like this is something a media outlet is reporting on. They've gotten access to exclusive information. They're revealing something. And what that allows for is then, you know, Dick Cheney goes on TV and he says, well, it's not me talking about Iraq's, you know, burgeoning weapons of mass destruction capabilities. You can read about it in the New York Times. But, you know, really, it's coming straight from the U.S. intelligence bureaucracy and it's not verified to begin with. So, I mean, that's just one. And granted, it's a it's a particularly sinister example.
Formative one that's, I think, informed how everyone who grew up around that time, and we're both millennials, I think the people who think about these things realize that media can be overly credulous and culpable, which is something that I think, for example, the perspective has been very helpful. I found very helpful to bring to the case, you know, all the reports about Chinese interference and trying to figure out what could the motivations for leaking this be? What is the legitimacy of this intelligence? How much should we qualify this? In the case of these alleged or supposed Pentagon papers, it's weird. I find myself not being as skeptical of this. I mean, there's this inverse thing where the harder it is to track down, the weirder the route it took to get to us, the more I'm inclined to believe it. And for all I know, that could itself just be another technique that it's used to add undue credibility. It's sprinkled out in a way that doesn't seem like it could be any, it at least seems too stupid to be anything other than organic. So one thing that maybe lends a, a little credibility, but not really, is that on Tuesday, the websites of the Prime Minister's office and the Canadian Senate were briefly taken offline by a Russian DDoS attack. That's a direct denial of service attack when a website's just bombarded with traffic till it overloads. And those were presumably to coincide with the Ukrainian Prime Minister, not Zelensky, the Prime Minister, meeting with Trudeau in Toronto. But of course, there's also a really big difference between a DDoS attack. I mean, who hasn't been subject to that? And, you know, getting into pipeline infrastructure.
So nobody could go to the Senate of Canada's website.
I know.
Devastating.
It's a good website, I found, actually. I've had occasion to browse it recently. The fact that it was the Senate, not even the House of Commons, does suggest that it was a foreign actor that isn't aware that, yeah, it's like...
It's not the United States Senate. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. This episode is brought to you by Article. Summer is in the air. Hopefully, this also means that we'll be spending a lot more time outdoors. In that brief period between Toronto being just too cold and too hot, it can be really nice. Luke, are you lucky enough to have any outdoor space where you live?
Yeah, I have a balcony.
Oh, nice.
It's very nice, as you say, for like 3 months of the year.
Article's curated catalog of outdoor furniture can give you some great inspiration for revamping your space. They got outdoor sofas, dining sets, you can have a dinner party out there, decor, and a whole lot more. And if you don't have any space outside, like me, maybe it's time to revamp some of your other furniture. They got stylish coffee tables, side tables, dining room sets. We just moved into a bigger office here at Candleland, and we made sure our Article couch came with us. It's really comfy and looks great in our new space and stands the test of time. Article is offering listeners $50 off your first purchase of $100 or more. To claim, visit article.com/Candleland, and the discount will be automatically applied at checkout. That's article.com/Candleland for $50 off your first purchase of $100 or more. Luke, as you probably know, on the show, we like to duly note things. Today, I'd like to note duly the situation at Cape Breton University. We all basically know at this point that post-secondary institutions in Canada are overly reliant on international students for as a source of revenue and typically inadequately support them or fail to sufficiently support them once they're here. Thanks to a segment on CTSW5.
Students, lured by promises of a quality education, left hungry, broke, and desperate.
There are no houses here. There are no jobs here.
I wouldn't let anybody live in that.
I learned that Cape Breton University in Sydney, Nova Scotia, sort of takes this to an extreme beyond what we've seen elsewhere. And not only is a majority of the student population international students, like three quarters, they've basically recruited more students than the city can physically accommodate. I mean, you know, a lot of places in Canada have affordable housing problems. It's very difficult for anyone to get affordable housing in any Canadian city. But it's gone to a point there where at least it appears that the university has kind of like created a homelessness crisis with people basically living in slum accommodations, sleeping in cars, basically staying with just families rent-free because they don't want to sleep on the streets, overwhelm the public transit system. And they don't have the classroom space, so they've rented like a Cineplex theater 9 kilometers away to ship students off to. It's kind of remarkable. And I mean, it makes me worry that like, is this where all of Canada is kind of headed? Not in terms of like, oh, we're going to have too much immigration or anything like that, but rather we've already failed to build out the infrastructure we need to support anyway, the people we hear, we want more people. We do a decent job of welcoming people, or at least of inviting people. We don't do a great job of keeping up with the infrastructure, whether it's affordable housing, whether it's transit, whether it's anything like that. At what point does any given population pass that sort of tipping point where what we have and even what we could plausibly build can no longer support or contain our population? What sort of investment would it take right now to avoid the entire country turning out a bit like Sydney, Nova Scotia?
Well, I think what we can or can't finance is very much a political question. And I mean, I think that whether we're talking about homelessness among international students at Cape Breton University and the sort of public infrastructure there not being adequate to meet their needs, or whether we're talking about homelessness in general, I mean, those things are in many ways just a direct consequence of treating public institutions like universities and the question of housing more generally, approaching those things with a market logic, you know, treating housing more as a speculative commodity than as, you know, a social need. The fact is we just need a lot more public housing and greater investment in public infrastructure in general, whether we're talking about universities or anything else, transit, et cetera. when it comes to housing, we need to put social need above, you know, the treatment of housing as a speculative commodity or as purely a site of profit.
And maybe not to the same extent, but people need education. Of course, the big reason that universities rely more on international students is because governments have not really greatly increased their per capita funding of universities, whereas their caps, their limits to how much they're allowed to charge domestic students, they can basically charge market rates to international students. And so trying to let the market fill in this gap or fill this hole, there are people who genuinely think that is the solution to everything. I've never really seen that that's been a solution to anything.
Duly noted.
Now, Luke, what would you like to note duly today?
Well, I will duly note a story that comes out of the United States. I mean, forgive me for offering a U.S. example here. That's where my head is often these days because of my job. This one comes courtesy of my friend Adam Johnson, who's a media critic. Mm. You can find his work on Substack and at Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. He recently published a piece on his Substack, CNN Sunday morning shows completely ignore up to 15 million Americans being thrown off of Medicaid.
Mm.
So this is a recent development in the United States. I mean, very significant in terms of the social consequences. It has to do with the kind of phasing out of various pandemic era kind of emergency programs, social supports, eviction protections, and then, you know, eligibility for certain programs, including Medicaid. And what Adam did basically is look at all the cable news coverage of this and found that, you know, it was more or less completely elided by all the major shows, which is to say they didn't even really cover it at all. So if you watched cable news, you know, within the window of time that Adam looked into, you would basically not be aware that 15 million people, you know, are about to lose their medical coverage. You know, he notes that print media did straight reports, but, quote, the framing was entirely in PSA format, how the individual reader or viewer could avoid becoming a victim of these cuts and how to best navigate the deliberately opaque system of benefits. In none of the reports was there any sense that this was a political debate with a potential political solution. It simply happened like a tornado or earthquake. One of the reasons why I chose this story is because, you know, we're talking today about fake news and disinformation and that kind of thing. And I think it's important to note that you can also have a kind of disinformation, as it were, of omission. Oftentimes when the media misleads people, I think, you know, it's not by directly lying to them. It's just by offering narrative parameters which kind of foreclose alternative ways, perhaps, of thinking about something. In this case, the fact that the Medicaid question, as Adam says, is a political question.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a random weather event. This is, you know, being decided by political institutions, the Biden administration, Congress, et cetera.
I love that framing. Narrative parameters. Duly noted.
This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's amazing the things that we tell ourselves to talk ourselves out of getting help. Anybody who's actually gotten help knows that the process of getting things off your chest, of taking your stressors, your problems, and just like not letting them be bottled up, working through just conveying them to somebody, half of the battle is just doing that. You unburden yourself. And you know what? If you have a real mental health professional, no, they don't have magic bullets or magic words that make it all go away. But often they can help you see things a little bit differently and guide you to strategies or tools or to a new perspective that actually does help. As the largest online therapy provider in the world, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. Because you listen to this podcast, you get 10% off of your first month at BetterHelp.com/CanadaLand. That's BetterHelp.com/CanadaLand. This episode is brought to you by Douglas, a mattress trusted by more than 200,000 Canadians from coast to coast to coast. Trust is important. There are a lot of mattress lies out there, a lot of mattress liars. And I didn't intend the pun, but it occurred to me that there is one as I was saying those words. Listen, I am not lying to you. I have experienced the Douglas mattress. It is an exceptional mattress at a surprisingly affordable price point. It is a mattress that sleeps cool, doesn't have that weird thing in the summer where the mattress gets like an oven. It's a very good product. It's delivered to your house in a box. You don't have to go to a big mattress store. It is a medium firm mattress, which is what Canadians prefer, and it comes with a 365-night trial and a 20-year warranty. What more can I tell you? Douglas is giving our listeners a free sleep bundle with each mattress purchase. Get the sheets, pillows, mattress, and pillow protectors free with your Douglas purchase today. Visit douglas.ca/CanadaLand to claim this offer.
So on Tuesday afternoon, the Canadian Press published a story with the headline, "Request to Remove Newspaper Article Among Ottawa's Queries to Social Media Giants." It's concerned a request from someone at the Immigration and Refugee Board of Canada who believed that an unspecified Toronto Sun article contained serious errors of fact, risking and undermining public confidence in the independence of the board, as well as the integrity of the refugee determination system. On September 27, 2021, they made requests to both Twitter and Facebook to have certain posts linking to this article removed. Both companies declined. The article in question was almost certainly a piece by the Alberta-based columnist Lauren Gunter, titled "Liberals to Make Immigration to Canada Much Easier." It reported on a leaked draft of a refugee board policy that, in his view, would make it vastly easier to claim asylum in Canada. And of course, this being the Sun, he didn't consider that a good thing. So, you know, things like, "The Trudeau Liberals are planning to remove nearly all grounds the Immigration Department uses to exclude applicants," the Toronto Sun has learned. "No longer will claimants need to prove, for instance, that they face torture or death if forced to return to their home countries, nor will they have to satisfy the UN's definition of a refugee." The Sun's take on the policy's effect was definitely an exaggeration and very likely misleading, or not just outright misreading. But reading that article now, it doesn't strike me as anything out of the ordinary for them or for any right-wing tabloid for that matter. And Gunter, the columnist, wrote in a follow-up column a few days later about how the board freaked out about his article and how its chair wrote to the paper about his egregious errors. And following the Canadian Press report this week, Gunter revealed that the board had asked his editors to correct or pull his column, which my editors courageously refused to do. His takeaway from the CP report was that, you know, he's quite certain that had my refugee piece been written after C11 instead of before, it would never have seen the light of day. C11 is the Online Streaming Act and probably going to become law soon. Without going too far into it, because that would be like a whole different conversation, let's just say that this concern of his is deeply hypothetical at best. Still, in the paper, the column on Wednesday ran under the headline, in all caps, "C11 Dangerous." But instead of digging into Gunter's columns, I want to examine the Canadian Press article instead. I mean, there's nothing wrong with it. It's a good story and a great scoop. But there's some context that could easily fall by the wayside if the takeaway is that the federal government is censoriously power mad.
What the Toronto Sun is complaining about here, and you know what the Conservative Party is likely to take up and complain about, in the grand scheme of things, it's not all that significant, right? There's a part of the federal bureaucracy that made a request, which was denied, to social media giants to take down a story from the Toronto Sun. Having said that, I don't think that conservatives hyperbolizing about something or kind of taking it in a very bad faith way and trying to blow it up into a grand narrative about government censorship or whatever, I don't think that that necessarily means that there's nothing to the story.
So once again, let's zoom way out. Luke, do you remember the Twitter files that Matt Taibbi, Barry Weiss, and other iconoclastic journalists shared last fall? Like, just a recap for listeners, the Twitter files, I guess, were these basically, sort of all traces back to this one thing in mid-October 2020 toward the end of the presidential election, where the New York Post wrote an article with the headline, "Smoking Gun Email Reveals How Hunter Biden Introduced Ukrainian Businessman to VP Dad." Wasn't a good article, wasn't anything extraordinarily terrible. Twitter took the unprecedented step, that, and which they've since admitted was wrong, of basically blocking all attempts to link to it. That gave the right all kinds of ammunition in saying, oh God, what else are they suppressing that, you know, the deep state or whatever doesn't want us to hear. When the Republicans took control of the House of Representatives back in January of this year, one of the first things they did was sort of launch an investigation into figuring out, like, what is going on here, partly launching it off of these Twitter file reports, things that these Musk-aligned journalists had tweeted out. It turns out there wasn't a lot. There were some takedown requests, but those were literally things that should not have been on Twitter anyway. So, like, as Rolling Stone headline put it, "Republicans are furious. Twitter took down pics of Hunter Biden's penis." So here's Florida Republican Representative Byron Donalds questioning Twitter's former head of trust and safety, Yoel Roth.
"But the email is very clear. More to review from Biden team. The response 3 hours later at the bottom, it says, handled these." What does handled these mean?
My understanding is that these tweets contained non-consensual nude photos of Hunter Biden, and they were removed by the company under—
Hold on, real quick, Mr. Roth, how could you know so much about the content of these tweets? I mean, as far as I'm concerned, these are just web addresses. I don't know what's in these tweets.
I think that the Twitter files story has become a sort of meta debate that really has more to do with how you feel about the people at the center, whether we're talking about, you know, the people reporting on it, or whether we're talking about the fact that Elon Musk was, you know, very obviously the source for it, the fact that the actual method of the reporting was kind of, you know, it was pretty wacky, it was a little bit irresponsible, like these giant labyrinthine Twitter threads, all that kind of stuff. But I still think there are important insights to be found in the story that if you can extrapolate them from some of the people involved in this, I think, a bit distracting meta debate that's ensued. I mean, the Twitter files did show, and you know, my colleague at Jacobin, Branko Marcetic, has done yeoman's work, I think, in going through this story, you know, actually reading all the reporting and trying to separate the bullshit and the hyperbole from the things that we should arguably care about here. I mean, what we do find in this story is that organizations like Twitter do have a relationship with intelligence agencies, with, you know, state actors, particularly the U.S. state in this case. I mean, there are just individual instances that are, I think, concerning. You know, I'll quote here from one of Branko's articles. In one instance, a U.S. Central Command official emailed Twitter to ask directly to whitelist certain Arab-speaking accounts possibly flagged as bots that, quote, we use to amplify certain messages and which, quote, had built a real following and we hope to salvage. One of those accounts, no longer in service, promoted the U.S.-backed Saudi-led war in Yemen and painted U.S. drone strikes as, quote, accurate and only killing terrorists instead of civilians. So, you know, I think it is significant anytime parts of a government bureaucracy, state bureaucracy, intelligence bureaucracy, whatever, are making requests of social media companies either to waive certain moderation rules for self-interested reasons or to kind of apply them in a more heavy-handed way against particular actors, whether that's, you know, actors in the press or anything else, that should be concerning. And I mean, frankly, I think Elon Musk's, I guess, still less than 6 month tenure at Twitter has given us plenty of examples of this. I mean, it's just in the past, I think, 10 days that The Intercept had yet another report about Elon Musk just censoring things on Twitter because the government of Narendra Modi asked him to. And, you know, that's pretty serious. And I think it's, you know, it's just as serious if it's a friendly government making the same request.
It's always very interesting. It feels like maybe they're not less than consistent about when free speech or what free speech means and what government intervention is appropriate and what is not. Now, the reason we're talking about all of this is because on the eve of those hearings, Canadian Conservative MP Dean Allison, who represents Niagara West, submitted a written question to the government, as is his right as an MP. He wanted to know about any requests made by the government of Canada to social media companies to take down, edit, ban, or change in any other way social media content posts or accounts since January 1st, 2020. Now, the government actually released its response to that on March 27th, and you can find the whole 159-page PDF buried on the Library of Parliament website. Essentially, the Privy Council Office circulated a form to every federal department, Crown Corporation and agency, about 120 of them in total, telling them to answer the question as it pertained to their organization. Social media was defined as including Facebook, Flickr, LinkedIn, Pinterest, Twitter, YouTube, Instagram, Snapchat, and Google+, which had actually closed down 9 months before the period they're looking at. So this was one thing, this request about the Sun article was one thing in this whole document that I think we can pretty much acknowledge was an overreach. It was inappropriate. It's not even clear whether they are asking for all links to this article to be taken down or just the Sun's links. But either way, that's shitty. What I found reading through this whole package is how aberrant that was. Most of the requests, so about three quarters of these entities, so like 90 of them, said they never asked any social media company to do anything. And the remaining 30 or so had about 210 requests between them. The Canadian press counted 214. And one reason for the different numbers, I think, for example, the Canadian Northern Economic Development Agency seems to have misunderstood the assignment and just listed posts that they themselves deleted because like they mixed up the French and English accounts. And also, fun trivia, the only entity to report that they didn't have any social media accounts is something called the Freshwater Fish Marketing Corporation, because I guess those pickerel sell themselves. Another fun thing is that there's a couple organizations that just said like, ugh, yeah, we do make these requests a lot, but we don't have a central record and we have so many accounts, there'd be too much work, so we're just not going to put this together. The only organizations that said that were the Department of National Defense and the CBC. All of which is to say, the weird thing from looking at all this is it feels like most of these reports were things that anyone would report, like impersonation, were
copyright issues,
some copyright issues, bigoted arguments in the LinkedIn comments, but it's all kind of run-of-the-mill stuff, and I figure if there are only 210 things reported across how many thousands and thousands of people or hundreds of departments, that's not so bad. And weirdly, they feel like the system actually kind of works, because anytime it did seem to be an overreach, the companies would deny those requests. But I don't know. At the same time, of course, you know, they're the one that admitted to having the most requests was the CSE, Communication Security Establishment, which is Canada's version of the NSA. But also, like, you know, CSIS just says, like, nope, we don't have to answer this. So what do you make of that? Like, where does this all fit in this whole morass of what is a weird, tenuous government relationship with social media where, I don't know, if we're all trying to figure out what the relationship is and what that means?
Well, in the case of this story, I mean, again, none of this seems very consequential. When it comes to kind of thinking about this issue in general, I mean, you mentioned the Hunter Biden laptop story. I mean, I don't think I necessarily agree that that was not a significant story. I mean, it's true that it's the New York Post. It's true they're publishing all kinds of salacious stuff. But I think, you know, that story was censored by social media companies, right? I don't think that's a good thing. I mean, if in response to requests made by politicians, you know, let's say there was no kind of social media company intermediary and the request was made directly to a paper, it was kind of a command, you know, take down this story. I think we'd all rightly regard that as pretty sinister, even if it was the Toronto Sun or the New York Post or, you know, a right-wing tabloid. I think the Hunter Biden laptop story, though, really needs to be seen in light of kind of another press story from 4 years earlier. I mean, to me, this was kind of an overcorrection to the Hillary Clinton emails story from 2016, where I feel like a lot of media outlets reported on that story and they felt that in doing so, they helped elect Donald Trump. So they wanted to avoid the same thing happening again. And the result was that we're not going to ask questions about why Joe Biden's son had this very lucrative job at an oil company in Ukraine while Joe Biden was vice president. I mean, I think it's fair to say that if that had been Eric Trump or Donald Trump Jr. with the exact same job, people would suddenly agree that it was in the public interest and that, you know, and people would find it very sinister, rightly, if social media companies were in the business of censoring a story like that. The basic test you should always do in the case of any story like this about, you know, social media companies moderating things in a particular way or sort of removing a story from a platform or something like that, it's always a good exercise to try to extricate, you know, whatever's going on from, you know, the dueling partisan narratives at a given time. Because, you know, the right's focus on the Hunter Biden laptop story, right, or the right's focus on the alleged Chinese election interference in Canada, it's bad faith, it's opportunistic, there's a lot of hyperbole, there's a lot of rhetoric, it's very self-interested. You know, the Conservative Party, I'm sure, going to the next election here in Canada, would love it if there was, you know, the impression that somehow, you know, the last federal election wasn't legitimate in some way.
Yeah, I mean, speaking of hyperbole and partisan ends, I mean, one of the least ambiguous examples of this sort of attempt to influence social media, I mean, this came down on, I guess, was Tuesday afternoon, where Pierre Poilievre performs, as Pierre Poilievre does, this tweet that just tries, just hits on all these little things and just like, it's, I want to say it's red meat, but it's more like, for his base, I would expect this to be like a perfectly medium rare meat, unless they like it well done. Anyway, we must protect Canadians against disinformation and manipulation by state media. That is why I'm asking at Twitter, at Elon Musk, to accurately label CBC as government-funded media. It is a fact, and Canadians deserve the facts. My immediate reaction to that is a groan. I just checked right now. Like, no, CBC still at least has not yet been labeled government-funded media, which it, I mean, it is, but...
Yeah, I mean, this is pretty standard fare. I think medium rare is probably about right for this. You know, the Poilievre tweet is very kind of opportunistic, and it just speaks to a narrative that I don't think is really true that conservatives in Canada have been running with for a really long time, including when they were in government, where they said, yeah, the CBC is this like radical left-wing institution. And I guess it's sort of piggybacking on something Elon Musk has been doing over the past week, which I think he labeled the BBC government-funded media. You know, he's kind of throwing around these tags in a very sort of cavalier way. And I guess Poilievre is piggybacking on the back of that.
And NPR just quit Twitter, right? Because they were labeled state media or some shit like that. Now it's government-funded media as of Wednesday morning.
There are all kinds of different models through which an outlet can receive some form of public funding, and they can involve more or less editorial independence, right? Presumably, Pierre Poilievre would not argue that the CBC is equivalent to something like Russia Today or like whatever the North Korean state broadcaster is. Maybe he would.
Yeah.
I mean, the BBC, I noted in their response to Elon Musk, said, you know, we're actually not government funded. We're funded by a license fee.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, to some people that might sound a little pedantic. I do think there are distinctions to be made here. There are nuances
in
terms of how this labeling is done. These tags, have never been applied in a way that is particularly consistent or coherent. And that predates Elon Musk. I mean, there's a lot of inconsistency here. There are a lot of organizations, media outlets, think tanks, et cetera, that do receive foreign funding. But if they receive foreign funding and it's from, you know, a U.S. ally, that's probably not going to be reflected in the tags.
I mean, there's definitely something always a bit almost destabilizing to be reminded that not necessarily the social media companies nor the government always have the public's best interest at heart. That's Shortcuts for this week. Thanks for joining me, Luke.
Thanks for having me, Jonathan. A pleasure as always.
Oh, thank you. We are on Twitter at CanadaLand. I think Jesse has said we're basically staying on it until the ship, whole freaking ship goes down. I'm still technically on Twitter, sort of. I am. You can email me at jonathan@canadaland.com. I will read, at the very least, read everything you send. Where can people find you, Luke?
Oh, you can find me on Twitter at Luke W. Savage. And you can find Michael and Us, my podcast, on SoundCloud, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts, your podcast app of choice, and at patreon.com/Michael and Us.
This episode is produced by Aviva Lessard with additional production by Tristan Capicchione. Our managing editor is Annette Ajofo. Theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Check them out online, cfuv.ca. If you value this podcast, please support us. We rely on listeners like you paying for journalism. As a supporter, you'll get premium access to all our shows ad-free, including early releases and bonus content. You'll also get our exclusive newsletter, discounts on CanadaLand merch, invites and tickets to our live and virtual events. And more than anything, you'll be part of the solution to Canada's journalism crisis, and you'll be keeping our work free and accessible to everybody. Come join us now. Click the link in your show notes or go to canadaland.com/join. You can listen ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime.
Hey, I need you to pay close attention to this message. It is not an ad. This is about Canada Land, and this is about you. You need to know that the news crisis is about to get a lot worse. You've heard about the layoffs. We're about to have news closures, and it's very likely that we're going to be seeing the defunding of the CBC. Where are you going to get your information from? What can you do about this? You can support Canada Land. We need you to. And so for this month and this month only, you can become a Canada Land supporter and get everything our supporters get for just $2 a month. That is an almost 80% discount. The clock is ticking on this. It disappears at the end of the month, and then we will not offer it. We need your support. We need to keep news coverage alive in Canada. Go right now to canadaland.com/join. And thank you.
A couple of years ago, a cop was shot dead on a deserted pier in the tiny nation of Belize. The only other person there that night was a frightened young woman found covered in blood. By all appearances, it was an open and shut case. But not in Belize, where this woman was connected to a mysterious billionaire who basically runs the place.
Justice will not be served in this case. She's gonna get away with it.
Or will she? White Devil. A Campside Media original. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.